Welcome to On Contact. Today we discuss the silencing of the left with Truthdig editor-in-chief Bob Scheer.
They have created an atmosphere of hysteria that if anyone questions military spending, aggressiveness, anything else, they're going to be thought to be agents of a foreign power. Come on.
On Contact with Chris Hedges. There is strong evidence that Google is suppressing public access to socialist and left-wing websites by using algorithms that divert users away from these sites when they type in certain keywords, such as U.S. military, inequality, socialism, and even figures such as Julian Assange. This censorship is being carried out as part of what Google, along with Facebook, Twitter, The New York Times, Washington Post, BuzzFeed News, Agence France-Presse, and CNN say is a campaign to marginalize fake news. Most of these organizations have strong links to the Democratic Party. RT correspondent Anya Parampel looks at the new McCarthyism that is underway to silence the left-wing press.
Alternative media is under attack like never before, particularly left-wing and anti-war outlets. Since the election of Trump, the establishment has been falling all over itself to stop the spread of what it calls fake news. There's just one problem. While the concept isn't really anything new, remember Saddam's weapons of mass destruction? Some forces have emerged to declare themselves the arbiters of fake news. Specifically, an organization calling itself Prop or Propaganda or Not came forward with a list of Russian influence operations it considers to be fake news. And while it did list RT and Sputnik, organizations which don't hide their connection with the Russian government and operate like any other state media, it also included sites like antiwar.com, Alternet, the Ron Paul Institute, Truthout, and Truthdig, all with zero evidence of the site's relationship with Russia or an influencing operation. They even included Press TV, Iran's state media channel. But this wasn't just a harmless list. Months later, Google announced it was changing its algorithm to filter out fake news. And many sites similar to the ones on that list or on that list have experienced a decline in traffic. Since Google has announced the changes, Alternet says it's experienced a 40% decline in traffic. In September, the World Socialist website reported a 75% drop in traffic since the changes took place. The attack on alternative sites led Julianne Tvetin, a reporter for In These Times, to coin the term the Russia fear-mongering industrial complex, saying the campaign is successfully marginalizing the left. RT reached out to Google and asked who exactly they consulted when designing their new algorithm and why left-wing and anti-war sites are being disproportionately affected. And they told us, quote, "Providing users with authoritative and useful information for their search query is our top priority. Because of this, we are constantly improving our algorithms to provide this type of content at scale across the wide range of topics people search for on Google. When we change our algorithms, it does mean some sites may lose visibility. Most importantly, we have never re-ranked search results to manipulate political sentiment."
Thank you, Anya. My guest today is Bob Scheer. He is the editor-in-chief of Truthdig, which has seen its traffic plunge by nearly 20% since the Google algorithms were put in place. I publish a column every Monday on the site. Scheer was formerly a reporter and columnist for the Los Angeles Times and the editor of Ramparts magazine. He is a professor at the Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism at the University of Southern California and the author of 13 books, including his latest, They Know Everything About You, How Data-Collecting Corporations and Snooping Government Agencies Are Destroying Democracy. So, Bob, let's talk about what we're seeing, what you have called repeatedly the new McCarthyism, only this time it's not coming from the rabid right wing, the Joe McCarthys and of the Republican Party, but from the Democratic Party.
Yeah, I consider this one of the most frightening moments, and I've been around a long time, by the way. I spent 29 years at the Los Angeles Times, legacy media, as a reporter and columnist and so forth. And I want to make one thing clear. Fake news has always been a problem. Okay, fake news comes from governments all over the world, particularly when it deals with national security. I was sitting there at
the CIA has made
sitting there at the Los Angeles Times 20 years after the Gulf had sunk in, which was this supposed attack the second one on by North Vietnamese PT boats on a destroyer and aircraft carrier of the U.S., you know, these huge ships, and it never happened.
Well, just like the attack on the Maine in the harbor of Havana, right. Never happened.
Okay,
right.
But a lot of people knew it, including the president and Secretary of Defense, Lyndon Johnson, Ron Mayer, and what came out 20 years after the fact when the key documents were finally declassified, and I wrote about it for the Los Angeles Times, they knew before they talked to the nation, the president and Secretary of Defense, that there was no evidence of an attack. They were warned by Captain Herrick. I interviewed him. The guy was on the destroyer saying, we recommend holding off. There is no evidence, you know. Admiral Stockdale, who was the longest-held prisoner of war, was up there in a plane. He couldn't talk about it because he was then captured and being one of the pilots sent over, and he ended up writing a book. He said, I was awakened, go bomb North Vietnam. I said, what for? They said, because we were attacked. And he said, there was no attack. I was flying above. So that's like the invasion of Iraq. We're talking really
right.
Major fake news. This is not some yo-yos, you know, somewhere in Russia or Ukraine or somebody, you know, doing stuff. And by the way, that kind of stuff is done by every government now in the world. That's what my book was about. As Eric Schultz pointed out, you can take third-rate stuff off the shelf and be a two-bit dictator somewhere, and you can get massive amounts of information, disrupt communication. This is what happened.
But the fact is that the charges that fake news somehow elected Trump, I mean, this is... it is true that every government does it, but they've not offered any evidence.
Okay, let me address this. This is the most shameful moment for the Democratic Party establishment in, I think, maybe in my lifetime. Because at least in the old McCarthy, this is the new McCarthy period, and the old McCarthy period, okay, it was coming from the right, the warmongers,
right.
You know, and they were attacking Democrats in the State Department, you know, for selling out or being subversive. Also, that red baiting campaign was based on reds. There were red revolutionaries,
right.
And they did have a program of, you know, revolution and so forth. The red baiting now is not directed at the last significant Communist Party. You know, I wouldn't mention North Korea. I don't think was ever really a Communist Party. But China.
Yeah.
Okay, and they've turned out to be the most splendid capitalists in the world. Splendid, at least in being able to make a lot of money and make products that people want. And Russia is run by people who I consider to be quite conservative. You know, I wrote the introductory preface to Oliver Stone, the transcript of Oliver Stone's interview with Putin, and Putin is very clear that he thinks communism is a failed ideology. It was always a pipe dream. He thinks Gorbachev was naive to think he could save it. And he believes in this kind of variation of crony capitalism. He's unabashed in his support of what I, as a progressive, don't like. I still have an idea we can have some social democratic society that is fair and just. So the irony in this red baiting is that it's fundamentally illogical. You know, Putin's Russia does not have a grand design to spread an ideology around the world. What it is it's old-fashioned nationalism. You could trace it back to the czars, if you like. You know, they were abused. I was in Russia covering it for the Los Angeles Times when Gorbachev was doing perestroika and glasnost and so forth. It was a feeding frenzy for American experts, NGOs, agents, blah, 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 all over the place. Yeltsin was their guy.
Well, the CIA put millions.
Yeah, Yeltsin was their guy against Gorbachev, really. And Putin came out of the St. Petersburg crowd, the subject and so forth. He was brought into the Yeltsin government. And then Yeltsin, in desperation, turned to Putin because he was the only guy that wasn't a drunk and out for himself and was competent. And he said, look, I got to resign, but you got to take over. And then Yeltsin wins the election the next year against the Communist Party candidate. So the red baiting is against a guy who was an anti-communist. And they bring up, oh, you know, it's KGB. Well, how many CIA people, you know, have we had in government? You know, what
well,
does that
mean?
We had
one as President Bush.
Yeah, the first President Bush.
But let's talk about what is it that the Democratic Party, first of all, let's talk about what they're doing in terms of the red baiting, and then tell me why they're doing it.
There are two forces operating here, and it's so disreputable because it's basically at the heart of it petty, yet its destructiveness is enormous. One is you have legend media, as it's called, the New York Times, Washington Post, particularly the Washington Post, you know, and others, whose business model is destroyed. So the Washington Post gets saved by Jeff Bezos, who buys it as his personal property. Meanwhile, his company, Amazon, is building the cloud for the intelligence agency, CIA. So you have the old military-industrial complex. And the Washington Post has been leading this attack, and the Russians are everywhere. Meanwhile, they're building the cloud for the CIA and the NSA and everything. And their guy, Bezos, owns the Washington Post. He's the publisher, so much for independent legend newspaper. But also the New York Times have been just beating the drum on this, you know, with no evidence that they've been able to come up with.
Well, so is CNN. So is MSNBC.
Yeah, but I'm talking about the publications that I really respect or have respected through my life. I mean, I like Dean Baquet, who's the editor of the New York Times. I think he's a solid fellow. I like Marty Baron, who's the editor. I mean, I've worked with these people. They were both at the L.A. Times when I was there. And I think it's really an embarrassment. I say shame.
So what's their goal? What are they doing?
They're doing it because their business model is broken, and this Internet, this crazy, wild world, yes, and the Internet is the best and the worst of everything. That's what I find it exciting. I edit Truth Dig, and we do good reporting. By the way, with traditional journalists, you know, Bill Boyarsky, who was at the city editor of the Los Angeles Times, is sort of our main political writer. You were at the New York Times. You're our leading columnist. And our copy editor is somebody who was at the LA Times, who can pull any story. So we actually are basically a publication done by people who left the LA Times or the New York Times or other places, as are many internet publications, whether they're for profit or nonprofit. But they're basically, it's convenient to the establishment papers that are in trouble economically to badmouth internet operations, okay, and say, oh, this is now the center of fake news. The fact is, fake news is exposed very quickly on the internet. That's one of the great things about it. You can say, wait a minute, I looked for the original document. I checked the history, you know, and people can find it really with dispatch.
We'll come back to that after the break. When we return, we'll hear more from Bob Scheer. On Contact with Chris Hedges. Welcome back to On Contact. Let's return to our conversation with Bob Scheer, editor-in-chief of Truthdig. So this red baiting, why is it dangerous? What is it, you know, what are potentially its effects?
Because it's disconnected with the world reality. Communism is not the menace in the world, okay? And Putin does not represent communism. He's an anti-communist. So it's an idiotic way of looking at things. As far as specific charge of who's threatening democracy, my own view is we're primarily threatened by our own intelligence apparatus that is setting a model for the world. If they can tap Angela Merkel's phone, if they can go into Russia and decide, if they can bring missiles up to the border of Russia, if they can, I mean, it's very aggressive stuff that's been going on as part of an idea that we're an imperial power. We cloak it with peace-seeking. And the lesson of our founders, it was George Washington who warned us about the impostures of pretended patriotism. If there's one truly, I mean, there's a lot of wisdom in the founders, but the most important, don't become an empire. If you become an empire, you're going to collapse like Rome and Spain and England and blah, blah, blah. And you, to have a democracy, you have to have more limited sense of your relevance to the world in terms of military and so forth. What we have is a full-blown imperial outreach, you know, and it's dangerous. And the Democrats have actually more of a war party now than the Republicans. I mean, they were under Johnson. They were even under Kennedy. They're very aggressive. And it becomes like a way of unifying the nation. They claim they're doing it for a larger good, human rights or something, but it turns out not to be the case. If you read Hillary Clinton's book about her time as Secretary of State, she brags about being far more aggressive than Barack Obama. pushing into Syria. And we know what disaster is. We know she voted for the Iraq war. We know that is about what she did in Libya. Is, you know, atrocious behavior. You got a defanged dictator and you sodomize him and you say, well, we came, we saw, and we conquered. I mean, this is brutality visible to the world. And the red baiting is an absurd, because there aren't reds, justification.
Okay,
what are the costs? And I'll tell you the cost. Russia still has half the nuclear weapons in the world, okay? And there is Russian nationalism. You poke your stick in their eye, and any nation, they're going to respond in ways that are not totally constructive, okay? You need Russia and China and Pakistan and India as allies, and Japan, clearly, and South Korea, if you want to deal with the North Korean problem, which is real, okay? If you want to have peace in Syria, you certainly need Russia to cooperate. So we've got this crazy situation now, and same with Iraq, same with Iran, and so forth. So we have this crazy situation where hopefully Trump could have parleyed somehow personal chemistry or something with some of these Ruskies into a better peace initiative. He now has to prove he's more belligerent than anyone. Right. Otherwise, his objectivity will be challenged. So, you know, to my mind, the demonization of any of these other countries, and by the way, even North Korea, you know, a country that was leveled, nobody even seems to know that.
Yeah, I know. We even bombed their dams.
Yeah,
there was nothing left.
How did these North Koreans get to be so crazy? I happened to go to North Korea once, you know, as a journalist. And I tell you, they take you to one museum after another. This is what the Chinese did to us. This is what the Japanese did to us. This is what the Americans did to us. You know, so nationalism, same with Russia. My mother, by the way, left Russia after the revolution. She was in a group called the Jewish Socialist Bund. Two of her sisters had been killed, you know, by the Cossacks, and then they ran afoul of the Bolsheviks. So, I was raised with that idea that the Russians don't always make right choices. But the fact of the matter is, you know, they have history. They have nationalism. They lost 50 million in the war, you know, World War II, when we were very late to enter. So you keep challenging the right of anyone else in the world to have a nationalism that has any validity. Well, as you know, because you've been a foreign correspondent most of your life, I certainly know from my more limited contact with the rest of the world, everyone has got a story out there of abuse and what was done to them. And if you just act as if that none of that matters, and only American nationalism, we're the only ones that were ever attacked. We're the only ones that were ever vulnerable. We always do the right thing. If you operate on that basis, now, yes, Trump is a bizarre manifestation of that with the Make America Great. But it was Hillary Clinton who said, oh, America is great and has
always been
great. Oh, yeah. When we committed genocide in California and wiped out Native Americans, had people throw babies in the fire. Was that an America that was great? You know, and those people were, you know, basically escape punishment. You can go through the history. Was slavery great? You know, so this whole thing that's been ushered in by the Democrats is, to my mind, really more ominous than what Trump is doing, because Trump is a buffoon. Trump will blow, unless Trump becomes more successful in being reasonable, and he's doing some things like cooperating with the Democrats on the budget limit, and maybe he'll do something with DACA, you know, and maybe he'll do some reasonable things and salvage his reputation. But the fact is, the cynicism of the Democrats is on full display. Play any trick. You know, Russia took over our land. No, Russia didn't cost you the election.
But why is it dangerous? What is the blow? What do you fear in terms of the blowback?
Because they are stoking the irrational xenophobia of America, of foreign enemies, that we have to get them. And now they have very few choices. I mean, they don't want to go after Saudi Arabia, which did, you know, paid for al-Qaeda. But they don't blame themselves for having created a situation in Afghanistan of great instability, because remember Zbigniew Brzezinski and Carter said, we're going to give them their own Vietnam. They don't blame themselves for being indifferent or not doing enough to solve real problems. Immigration. I was on that border when Jimmy Carter was president and Leonardo Castillo was his head of immigration, and you had all the problems you have now. You know, you didn't solve them. You've had all of the these years to have a humane policy on the border. The biggest problem, by the way, is not building a wall or not building a wall. Because, you know, what is humane about letting people across a desert not have water? I was on those patrols and everything. It's pathetic. What you needed is a reasonable quota, recognize the connection between Mexico and the United States, have a quota at least four times greater than what you have for Sweden or you know, a country like that.
But Bob, what are the consequences? How could this play
out?
The
consequence right now is that the Democratic leadership has destroyed or subverted a progressive alternative in America. They have created an atmosphere of hysteria that if anyone questions military spending, aggressiveness, anything else, they're going to be thought to be agents of a foreign power.
Which they've tried to target.
Doing this interview, let's cut to the chase. Just my being here doing this interview, and I've been on RT other times and so forth, you know, do I have to worry about, you know, people going to say, you know, I say, screw you, you know, I'm not going to fall for that, but other people will. People get intimidated. They'll have to prove how independent they are. They say, yeah, look, let's blow up a city in Russia or something. Yeah, you know, we'll be tough, you know, instead of examining how did the Ukraine part solve.
You
know,
well, you made a point before we went on the air that in the 1950s, it was a few good people within the Democratic Party who were standing up to McCarthyism. Now, today, we have essentially those people fueling.
You had a few good people in both the Republican and the Democratic Party who stood up. Eisenhower was a person who stood up at a critical point. We don't have moderates on the Republican Party. The ones who claim to be moderate, like Rubio and so forth, are actually more irrational on foreign. They want to go to war with Cuba or something. So, and the Democrats, one would have thought, would be a place where people who supported diplomacy and complex analysis and so forth would be comfortable, except now they have embraced a totally irrational, simplistic and extreme conception of what's going on in the world. It's nutso. I mean, to be talking about the Reds, I mean, to be talking about Russia as a revolutionary country when Russia is a deeply conservative country now. And I say that not with approval, I mean, but conservative in every respect, embracing the Russian Orthodox Church. You know, I mean, they are not, and they never really were. There was always a nationalist movement, even going back to Stalin. But now it's deliberately, you know, a nationalist psychology. Why? Because they've been battered. They've been battered, and, you know, and they will presumably move closer to the Chinese model, embrace a more vigorous capitalism and so forth. But the idea that somehow Russia is this big menace is a fraud. They know it's a fraud.
We're going to have to stop there. Thanks. Thank you for joining us. That was Bob Scheer, editor-in-chief of Truthdig. As long as most citizens believe in the ideas and ideologies that justify global capitalism, the power elites will remain unassailable. When these ideas lose their credibility, as they have, the institutions that buttress the ruling class deflate and veer towards collapse. An increasing number of Americans know that we have been stripped of political power. They recognize that we have been shorn of our most basic and cherished civil liberties, and they live under the gaze of the most intrusive security and surveillance apparatus in human history. Half the country now lives in poverty. Many of the rest of us, if the corporate state is not overthrown, will join them. These truths are no longer hidden. The loss of credibility is the reason the establishment, and especially the Democratic Party, is seeking to shut down voices and sites that respond to its mendacity and its bankruptcy. No longer able to compete in the world of ideas, all they have left is the blunt instrument of censorship. Thank you for watching. You can find us on rt.com/oncontact. See you next week.
He's so well known that there's actually a conspiracy to make sure that he's not well known. If you understand, if you get my drift. Because Dr. Amos Wilson is somebody who's been working relentlessly, quietly, all along, dealing with these problems that some of these psychiatrists are, you know, playing games with. Because if you read Amos's work, there is no question about what it is that has made our people react the way they have. It's the same thing happens to the Latino community, particularly the Puerto Ricano, and those brothers who and sisters who actually labor, you know, for the independence of Puerto Rico. I remember like when Lolita Lebron came here in 1994, and a lot of the brothers, Irving Flores and the rest of them, the people who in 1954 went up to the White House, you know, to see Truman the hard way, to let him know that there was a something called Puerto Rico and they wanted to have their independence. And they shot the place up. And I remember as a little kid, you know, wondering about, wow, this is really going to be in big trouble. It'll make them have a very difficult time, because you heard the adults saying that. And when Lolita came here, before she came, there was Mayor Dinkins, when he heard about it, said he didn't want any assassins or murderers, and there was a big to-do about it. And I wrote Lolita Lebron and told her to come ahead as the chairperson of the Harlem Reception Committee for Nelson Mandela. And she came, and later on she invited me to Puerto Rico, and I went down there to speak on behalf of the struggle here and the struggle in Puerto Rico. And I met with her at her house, and to see a person like that, that kind of spirit, that still remembers, you know, that they are committed to fight for Puerto Rico's independence. So when Amos Wilson talks about the struggle about African people and about that determination to break free of the control, because this whole thing is about control. It's about actually trying to dominate and control the mind space of people who, if they had their own free will, would strike out for freedom, which is the natural inclination of all people. And so Amos, what he does when he talks about the developmental psychology of the black child, is to show you at a very early age, you know, before these people start talking about 3 years of age or 5 years of age, what they're going to try to do to control the child. As a matter of fact, if you really look at it, this whole violence initiative is aimed at making sure that Amos's program doesn't work. Because Amos is trying to grab the mind of the black child to put it in a to put the child in a position where he will grow up normal and understanding he's an African and what that means and all that entails historically and even to the kind of demands that it makes on our present condition. So when he talks about, you know, so-called black-on-black violence and the psychodynamics of black self-annihilation in the service of white domination, he's laying out, you know, a whole idea about how black-on-black crime, whether in the United States or in South Africa, is not something that is genetically or innately, you know, and objectively just introduced into this whole struggle now, but it's something that is systematically placed there for a political reason. And that's to control the struggle of our people and really to take some of the best people off and have them, as Fanon say, develop into a campaign or a pattern of auto-destructive behavior. And therefore we become our own worst enemies. So there's Amos Wilson is the one who feels that allows us to break free of that because he understands more than anybody else how to get out of that particular pattern. With that in mind, you know, without any further ado, will you please welcome Dr. Amos Wilson.
Thank you kindly. Thank you very much for your warm welcome. It's a pleasure to be with you here again. It's been a while. It's not because I've desired to stay away, but it's because to a good degree I'm away to hopefully bring a new gift to the community. The gift I hope we'll be able to deliver into the community will begin around November. That will be the time when we will initiate a series of 10 weeks of lectures on power. I was talking here earlier to a brother who was talking about the fact that we describe these issues a great deal we talk about them and we analyze them, and we rarely get a chance to talk about solutions. Well, we've been working on solutions. We're going to talk about power not from the point of view of being victimized by it, but by developing it and using it against our enemies. At the last lecture I gave at the Slave Theater, where we were talking about global white supremacy, I initiated this theme on power by saying that we can explain the reasons Europeans victimize us in as many ways as we would like. We could talk about them as being ice people, as against the sun people, and that explanation is valid. Have no problems with it. We can talk about them in terms of their protecting their more recessive genes against our more dominant genes. We can even get into a little psychoanalysis and deal with the myth of length of penises and penis envy and all the other things, and black balls and white balls and brown balls and black holes and white balls rolling into black holes and things of this nature. And all that's fine. That's a lot of fun. But no matter how you explain why or how the European got to the point of victimizing us, I think the essential issue is that the European victimizes us because he can, because he has the power to do so. And we are victimized because we haven't developed the power to prevent his doing so. So in a sense, no matter how we explain why he does what he does, at the end point, he does what he does because he can. And consequently then, I infer from this that we can end his victimization of us when we end his power to do so. And consequently, I want to bring into the domain of discussion in this community the subject matter of power. I want us, in addition to studying black history and culture, to study power, its accumulation, its use, and application. We should talk about it every day and everywhere. We should read about it, and we should develop the means of using it. We should come to understand the nature of how white power is organized. In the end, power does not flow from the genes of white folk. Does that not flow from their ice age? It flows from the nature of their organization and the way they have chosen to relate one to the others. And it flows from their intentionality as a people and their appropriate organization of themselves to realize their intentionality, one of which is, of course, the domination of African people. And that means then that we as African people must study the rules of organization. We must study the means of relating one to each other in such a way that we multiply our power. And we must study our enemy's organization such that we can probe that organization and destroy the power of the enemy. And we can do it. We have a tremendous amount of power in our hands. Right here in America, we are not a weak people by any stretch of the imagination. The only weakness is in our minds and in our imaginations. That's the only place. We are not a dependent people in the material sense, only in the psychological sense. The only thing, ladies and gentlemen, we must get over is our cowardice. That's the only thing. down again. We can change this. I will speak briefly then to the issue this evening relating to the message that Dr. Bragan brought you last week around this conference titled Genetic Factors in Crime, Findings, Uses, and Implications, which was to occur at the University of Maryland. I've warned you many times and I've told you many times, I don't know whether it gets through to you or not, that we as black people must get over this thing of looking at schools and universities as advanced vocational training institutions. How many people recall that I've repeated this time and time again? That the function of education is not jobs. That is not the primary function. Children and people are educated. The primary function for education is to advance the interests of a people and to protect their interests, to secure their survival. That the educational structures and institutions of this country are as much a part of its defense, of its armed forces, as are its soldiers. The bombs, the weaponry that this nation uses against other nations and intimidates other nations with, develop out of the universities. The germ warfare, the chemical warfare, political, because some great professor is the head of this particular department, or they have illustrious names in the department, chances are you will never see them teach you in a class. The graduate students on some kind of assistantship will more likely be your teacher. Where are the brains and where are the professors? They're doing research. And often they're doing research on government grants for the government, for the corporations, for the other institutions in the society, and they are part of then the total system of domination of this country. Afrocentric education above all, and even beyond the teaching of African history and African culture, is preparing our children to defend the very lives of African people. Is a military preparation and a preparation for war. It is the means by which we will maintain our biological survival as a people. For if you do not survive, what does it matter if you teach reading to 100% of our children, or they learn math well, or they learn computer science, or all the other things you think are important, when your very lives are in the balance, and it is very likely that they will be snuffed out in the next 10 to 20 years. And yet we still continue to look at schools and colleges and universities as vocational institutions. And here we have then at the University of Maryland, long connected with the U.S. Army, by the way, hosting a conference on so-called genetic factors in crime. Bragan charged that this meeting, which was canceled, was part of a broader program, a violence initiative, a federal government research agenda, so that this program was only a part of a larger agenda. And it was designed to move toward finding a genetic marker that would supposedly identify children at high risk of becoming criminals and to develop plans to deter them through medication. And this is interesting due to the fact that there's little or no real information that links directly in any kind of strong way or even in a mild way a relationship between genes and criminality. There's been no DNA segment that has been discovered that codes for crime. When you think about it, the idea is ludicrous anyway. What is crime? What is violence? What is violence? In other words, I'm asking this question because you have to do a linguistic analysis. There are all forms of what? Violence. There are many different types of what? Crime. Different types of aggression. Not all violence is necessarily bad. There is what we in psychology may call hostile aggression. But there is aggression or violence that may be used in terms of what? Self-defense. Violence may be used to protect your children from attack. Violence may be used to protect the lives of other people. So now if we're going to get a gene for violence, or a type of violence, or in removing the gene for violence, if we were to find it, which is an unlikely situation, are we also removing a people's capacity to defend themselves and to use violence in their own interest? What I'm saying is then, be very careful when people use words like violence, aggression, crime, and so forth, and ask yourself, what kind of crime? You know, do we have a gene for every type of crime you can name? So that even when we change definitions of crime, a new gene comes into being that we're going to find related to that particular crime. And when we decide that certain other behavior is no longer a crime, will the gene which was coded for that crime disappear? Ludicrous. Ludicrous. I talk in Black on Black Violence about the structuration of crime. That crime followed the type of violence that we talk about, or crime, even its nature, follows the class structure and follows the skills levels of criminals. You see? Why is there so much so-called violent crime in certain segments of the society? Because when you look at the skills levels of the people committing them, if they were to commit a crime, that's about the only crime they could commit. If they were accountants, they would commit the crime of embezzlement and steal hundreds of thousands or millions because they have a particular ability or skill. And you'd be a fool if you were an accountant or in an S&L where you could steal millions of dollars and then make the public pay billions back and then hang out on the street and knock somebody out in the head. So here we have this crimogenic society that robs our people of skills and other means, so that if they decide to participate in a crime, then the probability is that it will be violent by the very nature of the way the society has set them up in the beginning. In other words, the society even determines the type of crime you are most likely to commit itself. Okay? And then it tells you, you're violent. Teach me to be an accountant. I won't hit any more people in the head. I'll just rob them by books. Okay? And then they want to talk about white collar crime and, you know, in the other kind of collar crime. Come on, wake up. This has nothing to do with genes. It has to do with the nature. I've also told you about reversal, right? I mentioned the fact that in order for us as a people to be in the situation that we're in, we literally have to be turned backwards. We have to think backwards, behave backwardly, deal with the world backwardly. It's necessary. This is the only way the system can maintain itself. Sometimes I say the best way to win an argument is to concede to your opponent. Okay, there is a genetic marker for crime. Let's now look at the criminal record of African peoples and European peoples. The record is clear. there is a genetic marker for crime, when we look at the fact that the European has committed a crime against every people on every continent, destroyed millions of people, then that argues for his genetic criminality. And that argues then for us to medicate him and control him. You know, the other thing I'm surprised at is we keep being surprised. We keep thinking that this is some new initiative. I mean, the violence initiative began with our enslavement and continues today. We already have fought the violence initiative, ladies and gentlemen. It is already operating. We bought it when we bought learning disabilities, when we bought the concept of hyperactivity, when we bought the concept of impulsivity, when we bought the concept of special education. You're already in it, connected to these so-called symptoms of learning disability. Are the very same symptoms they're going to try to connect to the so-called genetic markers. And our children are already being drugged. The violence initiative has already occurred because our youth are already going to jail in record numbers. So why are we talking about these people are initiating something to bring and put our youth in jail? They're already in jail. Those that are not already in jail are in juvenile detention, are under the aegis of the BCWs, you heard it tonight, in the special education program, already being drugged, already being therapized, already having their minds distorted in various ways. And the worst violence initiative program is the public educational system itself. So this so-called initiative that you're talking about tonight is a mopping up operation. That's all it is. If you're telling me in Washington, D.C. and other places, black youth and black people, 75% are in some form of contact with the criminal justice system already, some 60% in any given day in Baltimore and other areas already in contact with the criminal justice system? Well, then what will this new initiative do? Just make it what? 100%. We should have already been what? Upset. Why are we kicking and screaming now? We should have been screaming already. This initiative is an old trick in psychiatry and psychology. It's a trick that we call the medicalization of social problems. That is to define a social and political problem as a medical problem, and to put psychiatrists who are doctors, physicians with MDs in control of the definition of these problems, even though they are an arm of the state, as are social workers, as are psychologists, as are all of the other helping professionals, but members of the state and arms of the state. But we are so willing to submit to their authority, such that when they define social and political behavior and behavior which has social and political causes in medical terms, even the oppressed and the victimized consent to their mistreatment. Louis Sullivan is a part of this, but in a sense we are all a part of it, because we buy the medicalization of issues. And they know, since we are willing to do anything the doctor says, tells us to do, why are you taking that poison? The doctor said, take it every 2 hours. The doctor says. So now if the doctor says that your children have a marker, a genetic marker, then let's go with it. as soon as, and we don't have time the evening, one of these days we'll talk about psychiatric power and the role of psychiatrists in the system. Oh, the history of psychiatrists are horrendous. You won't believe it. You won't believe the tortures that have been created in the name of psychiatry that are even being perpetrated today. You won't believe the robbing of civil liberties, the robbing of freedom and all other kinds of things, the complete destruction and taking away of people's constitutional rights, but in the name of psychiatry. When you medicalize a problem and define it in medical terms, the patient loses all rights. And therefore, you can resolve a lot of issues that if they were defined politically or socially, would then become constitutional and legal issues. But as soon as they are put under the aegis of medicine, then you reduce to a very great extent the legal and constitutional implications. So what we have going here then is an attempt to move social and political problems into the area of psychiatry so that we, even as African people, can consent to social control and the killing of our people. One quick thing, and I know we're short here. Don't get caught up in this brain and biological basis of behavior. Okay? Don't be deceived because someone can say that they have found a biological correlate with behavior. That means it is genetic in nature, or that means it's congenital, or that means that the society has no responsibility for the behavior that the person is committing. Don't buy that baloney. And people run that a lot. You know, as soon as we can locate some kind of brain deficiency and correlate it, then we're ready to say, oh, society is not responsible for it. Are you kidding? Learning and experience physically transforms the brain. Traumatic experiences and even positive experiences changes the biochemical nature of the brain, as well as the neuronal functional organization of the brain, and influences the number of dendrites and synapses and other things that cells use to communicate one with the other. Now, you must understand here then, and I could talk a great deal here about the experiments here that have shown very clearly that if you put certain animals through certain experiences, their brains actually can increase in weight. Let me give you a quick run of things that happens when some rats were placed in various environments. One group was placed in a so-called enriched environment. These rats being selected from the same genetic background, having the same genetic background and the same genetic inheritance. But they were put in under different environments. After they were put through, after they lived in these environments for a while, they were sacrificed and their brains looked at, weighed, measured, and analyzed. Now, those rats that were put in an enriched environment, let's look at some of the things that were found. They had an increased thickness of the cerebral cortex, or the gray matter. In other words, the thinking matter of their brain increased in thickness and weight. A 15% increase in the actual size of the neurons in the cortex. Increases in protein in the brain paralleling the increases in cortical weight, indicating that the growth effect was on tissue and not just on the fluid content of the brain. An increase in the amount of dendritic branching, dendrites are the hairy branching fibers which project in large numbers from the body of each neuron and which receive input from other neurons and conduct them to the cell bodies of other neurons. There was an increase in the branching of these neurons, and a greater amount of potential information was available to each neuron. An increased number of dendritic spikes per unit length of dendrite. Increases in the number of synapses and the sizes of the contacts between the synapses. An increase in the ratio between the weight of the cortex and the weight of the rest of the brain. A 15% increase in the number of glial cells, and on we go. What are we saying here then? That experience changes the brain, changes the nature and the functionality of the brain. So simply because you may find a brain correlate does not take society off the hook. It means then that if society controls the experience of a people, controls their experiences, it is manipulating their brain and controlling its size. And so they want to run a game on you with this biological substrate number. A quick reference here to some tentative research that was noted in the New York Times Wednesday, September 16th. And you should read this piece, and the research is tentative, but read the scientific journals. But there's something interesting here. The headline reads, "Behavior therapy can change how the brain functions," researchers say. "Like drug therapy, behavior modification therapy produces metabolic," what do we mean there? "Chemical enzymatic changes in the brain and functional changes." That is how different parts and areas of the brain relate one to the other in controlling a behavior and initiating a behavior. Know what I'm saying? Like drug therapy, behavior modification. This is a non-drug therapy, right? This is a therapy based on social relationships between the therapist and the client. Okay, and that's what we are comparing here. And what does it say here then? Both of these produces metabolic and functional changes in the brains of people with obsessive compulsive disorder. It is the first time that behavior therapy, remember we're talking about a basic social thing here, even though there's some other adjuncts to it, a method that changes the way people think, and I'm emphasizing think, about uncomfortable thoughts or feelings, the way they deal with uncomfortable thoughts and feelings, this therapy particularly relating to obsessive compulsive behavior where people are exhibiting certain attitudes toward compelling thoughts and behaviors. So this therapy, which seeks to change the way they think about these compulsive feelings and think about these thoughts and these urgings that keep telling them to do things, has been shown to physically alter brain function in a mental disorder. And we could go on, the piece is longer. I brought this up to get those who might think that we only talk about rats. What are we saying here then? That the very nature of human relations itself can change the functional nature of the brain. The idea being then that even when they come to you and tell you that there's some kind of correlation between a brain functionality and a particular behavior, don't fall for the okey-doke that necessarily means that the society is not responsible for producing that behavior. Society shapes the brain as it shapes other things as well. I'll move on quickly here. The theme of black-on-black violence, the book, is that the alleged criminality of black males will be used to justify the repression of the African-American community and quite possibly its genocidal annihilation. In other words, the running theme of the book, Black-on-Black Violence, is this: that the alleged criminality of African males will be used as a major rationale so that when this society decides that it will annihilate this community, the other members and nations and people in the world will buy it because they have been convinced that we are innately criminal. And what I'm trying to get across in there then is how this propaganda is developed. This is why, despite what you say from a logical point of view, despite the fact you may say this is not the majority of our youth who are in jail. The vast majority of our youth are not engaged in violent behavior. The majority of people on welfare are not black people. The majority of people in prisons are not black folk. You know, you can lay one fact after another. And yet what happens? The people still insist in seeing it as a black problem, don't they? When you lay evidence and facts before a people, even evidence and fact that they themselves have collected, and they still insist in seeing you in a particular way, then you must recognize that they are seeing you in that way because it is important to their own psychological state of being and because it serves their own interests. Yes. And you must ask the question then, why are they obsessed about projecting this kind of image? And you will see then that it is there to rationalize their behavior against you. They're not, and therefore, as I will say a little later on, this idea of arguing with these people point for point is not what the game is about. It's not what it's about. Let me quickly move on. I want to lay a context, because often we discuss these issues out of context. And I've told you before, as I've told you in Black on Black Violence, that European sociology, psychology, and so forth decontextualizes issues, meaning that it discusses violence or crime as if they do not exist within a social context, as if they do not have a history, as if they do not serve a function in the society. So you're made to look directly at the behavior and the behavior only, and to judge it and treat it without looking at the context in which it occurs and look at how the context itself may create the behavior. And even behavior therapy plays this game, by the way. Okay? You must start at the context first before you discuss these problems. What is the context? The context is this, that we are a dominated people. We are dominated by European people. Am I making myself clear? Yes. This is where we start. This is where you start. We are under the control of another people. We are vulnerable to that other people who are holding our lives and the quality of our lives in their hands. That's the fact you must start with. The second fact is, domination is a social problem. Am I clear here? Domination itself is a problem. It is a social problem, particularly for the dominated, isn't it? Even if it's for the dominator, it's still a social problem. Keep this in mind. Domination, therefore, generates the very existence of domination means that a social problem has been what? Generated. Huh? You can't have domination without having a what? Social problem. So domination generates a social problem, and as long as it exists, it maintains that social problem. As long as you're under the domination of Europeans, you will have social problems. There are some idiots among us who think that they can leave the European in control of African people and get justice and peace. It is not possible. Domination is built on injustice. And you cannot then leave the European in power over black people and then expect to be to receive justice. It's illogical. It's not possible. Domination benefits the dominator. We are dominated because it what? Benefits those who dominate us. Therefore, the dominator benefits from the social what? Problems. In other words, the problems of black people benefit white folk. And they are created for their benefit, and they are maintained for their benefit. And therefore, those who dominate us have an investment, monetarily and every other way, in perpetuating the symptoms of maladjustment in us as a people, and they engage in interactions that reinforce those problems. That's why no matter what kind of program they lay out for you, it does not resolve the social problems that they claim they're designed to resolve. And I'll be through in just a second or two here. The problems of the dominated provide evidence which justifies their domination and supports their own domination. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the major outcomes of power and one of the major benefits of being powerful is that you can generate the evidence to justify your power and to justify your domination. Why, when I go to prison, I see that 56% of you are in this prison. Therefore, we are justified in controlling you. But then we forget how what they created the problem so that 56% could be in there. Now then, as the gentleman who wrote Blaming the Victim put forth, and I will say, first of all, this problem is created. Our problems are needed. This is what I'm arguing in Black on Black Violence, that this society needs the criminality of black males. It needs the fantasy that black males are criminals. It is necessary to the very structure and being of this society. It is very necessary to the self-definition of Europeans. It is very necessary to maintaining their domination and advancing their domination. Therefore, they must create these problems, or they must even imagine that these problems exist where they truly do not exist. Therefore, they create the problem, and then, as Ryan argues, first they identify the social problem, second they study those affected by the problem and discover in what ways they are different from the rest of us, this great underclass. How are they different from the rest of us? And you know now, arguing black on black, that the so-called criminals in the jails are not any different from any of the rest of us. You are not going to find a criminal personality. You know, and yet that's been the golden grail of psychology. You know, how can we distinguish these people from the rest of us? We're all in this game together. Third, they define the differences as the causes of the social problem. In other words, we create the problem. Then we go in and look at the people who have the problem and see how they're different from those who don't. And then we say, oh, their differences is the reason why they have the problem. You see, so they're going to create these brain dysfunctions, then go in and find the brain dysfunction, and then say the brain dysfunction is the cause of the problem. Now let's medicate. So they define, they use the differences, and finally they assign a government bureaucrat to invent a humanitarian action program to correct the differences. I asked my class the other night, what if we could find a 100% sure shot rehabilitation program? A program that would rehabilitate 100% of the clients. Would that solve your problem? No, because what would happen? The others would keep what? Rolling in. Rolling in. So rehabilitating the ones who have the problem does not solve what? The original what? Cause of the problem. And again, we hear people who enter into the wrong point of the equation. Let me get here then and say, these controversies, such as the one we are dealing with now, they speak to the need for domination to justify and maintain itself. Howard Zinn stated, the establishment, whatever rewards it gives us, will also, if necessary, to maintain its control, kill us. Hear that, black bourgeoisie. part of your being promoted in American society is to maintain control of the black community. The day that your death is necessary also to maintain control and to maintain white power, they will kill you as well. And I want you to keep this in mind then. I don't want you to fall into the trap of discussing this particular issue. We fall into a trap by concentrating on the scientific and methodological details. You know, well, there's no genes. When you find it, forget all that nonsense. And get caught up in personalities. Well, Goodwin is an evil guy. You know, Louis Sullivan is a... Screw all of that. It's the same kind of thing you have with Columbus. If Columbus had not discovered America, some other European would have. Even if you could step back into history and kill Columbus, you'd still be in the same shape you are right now. Because what is the essential problem here? Columbus didn't build the ships. Columbus didn't build the technology. It was European technology, political and economic organization that made it possible for Columbus to come over here. And it was European technology, organization, intentionality that made it possible for them to overrun the Indian nations. What you had here then were two different cultures and two different technologies and two different ways of thinking facing each other, and one ran over the other. Not Columbus. I want you to get out of the personality issue and deal with the deep issue. You are facing a society and a culture. You are facing an organization that will put man after man after man in front of you, but it will still run its same program. You must learn to cripple the organization, not the person. This is an old argument. It's the same kind of old game that went on with the genetic basis of intelligence. Just the same old game refried. What do we have here? Let's look at the deeper issue. And the deeper issue involves the need to justify domination, social control, and to obscure the very real way deficiencies are created by power relations. Quick question here. Why are whites obsessively concerned with the intelligence of black folk? This is the thing you must ask first before you get into whether it's environment or genes. Ask the major question. Why are you interested? What's the point? Huh? Why is it so what? Important for you to know. What are you going to do with the knowledge? This is the issue. What would be the result if it was definitely and irrefutably established that blacks are innately less intelligent than whites? Let's ask that question. Let's ask another one. Are we found irrefutably that we were more intelligent than whites? What would be the results? Are just as intelligent as whites, or that environment is really significantly influential in determining intelligence? What would be the result if we discovered either one of these things? What would be the result if we proved that blacks were genetically more docile than white folk? The end result would what? Be the same. Would be the same. Nothing is going to change. Why? The findings, whatever their nature, will be used to justify and rationalize the social control of black people by white people. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, if they proved that we were innately less intelligent than they would justify domination, wouldn't it? We are more intelligent, therefore we have a right to rule over you. But then if you prove to them in your great work that you are more intelligent than they are, well, these people are more intelligent than we are. We should suppress them while we can, because if we let them loose, they will take over. So the repression would still take place, and it would still be argued. Well, they are as intelligent as we are, and that means one day they may compete with us, so let's still what? Repress them. Oh, the environment is truly significant in intelligence. So what would the result be then? Let us control what? The environment to control their intelligence. In other words, ladies and gentlemen, the final come down of it all, no matter how you refute these people, no matter how much detail you roll out one way or the other, they will always be used to do what? Justify repression and oppression. That is the issue, not making fine pointed arguments as to whether IQ tests are culturally based or genetically based or this so-called initiative here. It's pointless. What we have going here is an attempt by people who are dominating us to create new rules and means by which they justify their domination and repression. That's all that's going on here. Screw whatever excuse they rolled up in time. The only thing that has changed by any so-called new initiative, such as the one we're talking about today, is the logic of justification for continuing domination and the methodology of domination. That's the only thing that's changed. Nothing's changed by this new initiative. All they said, well, their violence is a medical problem, and therefore, now the methodology for that is to do what? Cut their brains out and medicate them, so forth. But the end result is still what? Domination and control. Thus, the central issue revolves around power and domination and maintaining the relative powerlessness of black people and finding rationales for doing so. For a very sizable percentage of black problems flow from the nature of black and white power relations. These problems that we are dealing with flow from our powerlessness, from the power differential between blacks and white folk. They reflect the differences in power between us as people. Nothing else. No brain issues here. The issue then for the black community is this: how to break white power and the will of whites and any other ethnic group to dominate and exploit African people. And I'm telling you, any other ethnic group, because whites are not the only ones who are moving in place to dominate African people. And the issue then is this, and you must keep this in mind. This must be our agenda. This is our agenda, to break the power of people to control our lives. This is the agenda. An agenda set by us, not by others. Our program for change and empowerment, for enhancing the education of our children, for maximizing our quality of life, should continue regardless of academic and social debates regarding the social or genetic bases of criminality, intelligence, and so forth. What am I saying? We must keep focused on changing the nature of power in this world, regardless of the debates about what is going on. If you get caught up in the details, you're going to lose the focus. One other thing, and I'm through. We got some people out here looking for conspiracies. I want to note this because I see a lot of this going on, and there are people on the circuits getting over on the conspiracy number. And there are others, you know. Let me just warn you about one thing, black people. You must think in terms of a nation. You must think of yourself as a nation. It's very important that you think of yourself as a nation. Many of the issues that you see confronting you can become very clear if you think of yourself as a nation surrounded by other nations. I tell people, I haven't written the second book on the cause of violence, the economic cause of violence, but there is an economic cause. I talked about the psychodynamics in black on black, but there's another part of the story, which is the economics. Quickly, it's like this, ladies and gentlemen. If you saw black people in the United States as a nation, you would recognize that to a very great extent, the social disorganization that we complain about, the breakdown of families and institutions, the criminality of our children and so forth, is a result of the fact that as a nation, black people are suffering from a negative trade imbalance, from a trade imbalance. In other words, black people have an overwhelming national debt. What do we mean by that? It means that more of your money, earnings, income are flowing out than what? Are flowing in. You jumped for equal opportunity and you educated your most talented people and you sent them away from you and sent them to work for other people, and the monies they earned, you told them to live among those other people so they contribute their brains and skills to your enemies and spend their monies among your enemies and enhance their power, and now they become neoconservative and join the attack on the African community. You understand what I'm saying? Anytime a nation buys more than it sells, anytime that a nation ships its wealth out in great bundles, anytime a nation lets other alien groups, Arabs, Koreans, and others, and whites, come into its midst and take its money out, and then let the drug dealers scrape up the rest and take that money out, their institutions are going to collapse on their heads. Your families are breaking up because they do not have the economic floor that they need to keep them there. Your children are going wild because you don't have the money to give them the appropriate education and recreation and other kind of things you need. You cannot build the institutions that you need to maintain the viability of your society because you're giving it to everyone else. And you're shipping it out. And therefore you suffer from it. Now, with this view in mind, what does this mean? You can solve this problem to a very great extent if you think of yourself as a nation, remove the aliens from your midst and thrust out into the world and earn wealth and money and bring it back to your nation and watch its prosperity increase and watch the people become more civil with one another, build the kind of institutions to create the kind of schools you want. But until you do that, it's not going to happen. This is the program. Conspiracy, then. There are people out here looking for the mad scientist who made the AIDS gene. And now they're looking at Goodwin. Is he? Oh, he's the mad man that's getting ready to run the nut sort of thing. And there are others who are in the government huddling around. Screw all that. Stop wasting your time hunting for the smoking gun. When you are a nation, you recognize one thing. When you discover the conspiracy, it's too late. Yeah, it's too late. When you discover it, it's too late. If you are a nation, you know what you act on as a nation? You act on capability of your enemy. They can be your friends, as a matter of fact. They can have good relationships with you. But the moment they develop the capacity to destroy you, you don't worry about whether they hate you or love you or they're conspiring against you. You recognize that they have the capacity to destroy you should they what? Want to. You don't search for the conspirators. You search for a way to defend yourself against one what? Should it occur. It's the fact that whites have the capacity to use AIDS that should move us to build a defense. That they have the capacity to destroy African nations that should move us to build a military. That they have the capacity to destroy our people in economic warfare. Not whether they are thinking of doing so or whether there's some person who's doing so. Screw that. Don't put the energy in what? Building a defense and an offense on the fact that they are capable of doing so. All right? It's necessary. So, ladies and gentlemen, our eyes, we should do what? Keep the agenda on changing the power relationship, empowering ourselves so that we can defend ourselves regardless of the type of conspiracies any groups have against us. So what does it mean, ladies and gentlemen? keeping our eyes on the prize. And that prize is power. Power to the people. Thank you very much.
Okay, that's it for today. This has been Wake Up Call on Radio Justice. I've been your host, Bernard White. And until next time, stay strong, pay close attention, and never give up.
The higher you build your barriers, the taller I become. The farther you take my rights away, the faster I will run. You can deny me, you can decide to turn your face away. No matter, 'cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can make it. You're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. Oh no, something inside so strong. Oh, something inside so strong. The more you refuse to hear my voice, our lies will come tumbling. Deny my place and time, you squander wealth that's mine. My light will shine so brightly, it will blind you. 'Cause there's something inside so strong, so strong. Know that I can make it. Oh, you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. Oh no, something inside so strong. Oh, something inside so strong. Brothers and sisters, when they insist we're just not good enough, well, we know better. Just look them in the eyes and say, we're gonna do it anyway. Gonna do it anyway. Something inside so strong. And I know that I can make it. You're doing me wrong, so wrong. Oh, then my pride was wrong. Oh no, there's something inside so strong. Oh, something inside so strong. Insist we're just not good enough. When we know better, just look them in the eyes and say, we're gonna do it anyway. We're gonna do it anyway. We're gonna do it anyway. Something inside so strong.